Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kochański, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 19th of October. Trying to write about this week without mentioning Pope St. John Paul II, whose feast day is on Wednesday, is like trying to write about the last quarter of the 20th century without once mentioning his name. During that time, more people in the world must have been able to answer the question, "Who is the Pope?" than at any time before or since. It was all almost an accident. In 1978, Pope Paul VI died. All I can remember about that Pope is that he was the Pope. This may be just me being stupid, but the thing is, we ordinary people all knew what popes were. Popes were good. Popes were nice. Popes told us to be good and nice too. When one of them died, another was elected, and so it went on. And of course, all of them were Italian. So then, in 1978, everything proceeded just as usual. The cardinals came together, and in secret conclave they elected John Paul as Pope. He was good. He was nice. He was Italian. No doubt he would have spent his time telling us to be good and nice too, but in 33 days, suddenly, he was dead of a heart attack. It was God telling us that we had not got it quite right. Autumn in Rome, then, another conclave. All the world's press back again. They dug out their lists of the runners in the last race and got ready to tell us all about whichever Italian horse won the race this time round. His history, his opinions, anything to make us feel wise at once without having to think. On Monday the 16th of October 1978, white smoke came pouring out of the chimney. The reporters waited to hear which candidate had been elected, ready to look up their notes and sound very, very authoritative before their time was up and "we return you to our scheduled programming." And it was a disaster. They couldn't talk about which candidate because the new Pope wasn't on their lists. He was not a which candidate at all, but a who. Definitely and supremely, he was a who. He was not an Italian. He was a Pole, and Poland up till that moment had been one of those countries stuck behind the Iron Curtain and you feel sorry for them, how sad, and go on to think of something else. But how can you feel sorry for a country which has just produced the first non-Italian Pope for centuries? It was most disturbing and confusing for the press. It took the BBC half the afternoon just to teach their reporters to pronounce his name, Karol Wojtyła. I watched them slowly getting better at it. It was funny to see, but it was not time wasted. This Pope was going to be in the news, and high in the news, for a very long time. What about niceness and goodness, then, the other qualities of popes? Well, niceness, I can't say. He had a face carved out of rock, but at least it was friendly rock, rock that was on your side. As for goodness, yes, of course, but it was goodness of a very different kind. The new Pope took the name John Paul II in homage to his predecessor. That was the last bit of continuity we were going to see for some time, the last bit of business as usual. Though even as I'm saying this, I'm wondering about John Paul I. Perhaps his election wasn't a mistake after all. You know how sometimes you are walking along and you come to where there is a step up or a step down, and you find you are just half a pace away from where you ought to be, so you take a quick half-step, half-skip, to get the rhythm of your feet in the right place? I wonder. I have never understood how institutions work, and no one ever understands the workings of the Holy Spirit, but just conceivably Pope John Paul I was providential in his way. He was that half-step, half-skip, which made the election of Karol Wojtyła possible. Pope St. John Paul II is celebrated this week, which is a little odd because he died on the Sunday after Easter, and we usually celebrate saints on the date of their death. The thing is, we don't like putting important saints near Easter because the calendar gets too complicated. That Sunday is now a permanent memorial to him in any case, because we used to call it Low Sunday, until John Paul II renamed it to Divine Mercy Sunday. The people who decide these things decided to make John Paul's feast the 22nd of October because Sunday, the 22nd of October 1978, was the date of the new Pope's inauguration. There could be no better date than this. It was the end of business as usual. It was the beginning of the fall of the Iron Curtain and the end of the Cold War. History was about to turn a corner we thought it would never turn. This time the cardinals had elected to the papacy not a clergyman, but a man. You looked at him, and whoever you were, you said to yourself, "I ought to be like this man." He had the toughness we more usually associate with female saints like St. Teresa. When his enemies or his friends told him it would be best not to do something, or safest, he went ahead and did it anyway. It was the logical outcome of the life he had led. Karol Wojtyła had not got where he was, papabile, as they say, ready to be poped, by rising steadily through the ranks of the clergy and always being in the right place at the right time. He had been in many wrong places. As a young man, he had done forced labour in the stone quarries, and it showed. From his youth, he had endured experiences that would have crushed most of us, and that showed too. He was a priest in a country officially dedicated to the elimination of Christianity. He was a bishop in that country. He had had to exercise more toughness each week than most of us do throughout the whole course of our lives. I'm spending a lot of time on who the new Pope was. That kind of thing doesn't usually come in the history books. They prefer words and actions. But who the Pope was more important than what the Pope did. Indeed, what he did came out of who he was. If you think about it, the ordinary people, the sinners who followed Jesus first for who he was, and only then for what he said and did. John Paul gave us the most important message of his papacy just by being. By being who he was, he showed that it was possible for real people to believe in God. Real people, someone like you and me. Belief in God was not just for vicars and church mice. Belief was possible, and more than possible, it was necessary and beneficial. Believing in God made us more ourselves, because faith is the only sure underpinning of one's personality that there is. All this is to say that a big part of what God needed a new pope to accomplish just then was accomplished before the new pope even did anything at all. You can still look at a picture of Pope St. John Paul II today and catch yourself saying, "I want to be like you." Being is good, but in the end, being isn't enough until it blossoms out into doing. The action started at once, in Pope John Paul's inaugural sermon on Sunday the 22nd of October 1978. The words he uttered then set in motion the freeing of 100 million people from slavery, but looking to the future, that may have been the least of their effects. This was not a loud call to action of the kind you might expect. People, rebel. People, rise up against your oppressors. Nothing like that at all. Instead, the Pope's sermon was an affirmation of the ultimate value of the human person and of human integrity. The message was simple. It was eternal. Indeed, it had all been said before. The Archangel Gabriel had said to Zechariah, "Do not be afraid," and to Mary and Joseph, "Do not be afraid," and to the shepherds, "Do not be afraid." The Pope said to the people of the world, "Do not be afraid. Welcome Christ and accept his power. Do not be afraid. Open wide the doors for Christ. Let Christ speak to man. Do not be afraid. For Christ alone knows what man is." If you've ever seen a Roman wall, then you'll know how different they are from ours. Roman walls are built of very flat, thin bricks, quite unlike the thick, solid ones we use. But out of these little, thin things, the Romans built walls that have lasted 2,000 years. The wall of totalitarianism is built on little bricks of fear. One of the Pope's biographers gives a good example. Think of a greengrocer who, along with his daily delivery of apples and onions and cabbages, receives a big banner to put in his window saying, "The party is the vanguard of the people." Does he believe what it says? No. Does he put it up? Yes. Otherwise, someone will notice. Someone will notice that he exists. There will be a file. Other pieces of evidence will be put together. Then, somehow, when his child needs a good school, there won't be a place, or when he needs permission for his outdoor displays of fruit, the permit will be strangely delayed. And all for what? All for a bit of paper that doesn't mean anything anyway, so let's put it up and have done with it. The party is the vanguard of the people. Everyone who knows you will know that you don't mean it. They will understand that you have put it up as an act of conformity, an act of prudence, a visible way of making yourself invisible. There is no iron curtain now. The people have been set free. But the methods that were used to enslave them have been set free also. In the English-speaking world today, you can be arrested for speaking the truth, interrogated, even imprisoned. Or best of all, they can put you on a list. It is all very humane. Perhaps you won't get the job you want, or a proper education. Perhaps your tax affairs will be investigated. Perhaps you will not be allowed to fly, just for security, you understand. The modern state has so many humane methods of pest control, it doesn't make martyrs of people, but it does make an example of them. The blood of the martyrs may be the seed of the church, but quiet, half-conscious fear is the seed of nothing at all. In 1978, all the Pope had to say was, "Do not be afraid," and the solidity of those walls made out of little bricks was gone, just like that. They were only ever an illusion. I am not saying that the risks of not being afraid weren't real. They were very real indeed, just as they are now. But still, the Pope could say, from his long experience of living under occupation and totalitarianism, and surviving them and fighting for human integrity, "Do not be afraid." He was not someone comfortably standing outside the fence preaching courage to those within. He had been in there. He knew. That was the world when Pope John Paul II began his reign. That leaves the Church. The Church, it has to be said, was in a mess after the Second Vatican Council. She was like a patient who has been through a life-saving operation and wakes up in a corridor on a trolley that everyone bumps into as they pass by, ignored, neglected, meaningless. We were told that everything we had believed in the past, everything the martyrs had paid for with their lives, was untrue. As for what was true, for what was meaningful, nobody would tell us. Now, Karol Wojtyła never thought of the council as a meeting that would finish its work when it finished, with a sigh of relief, and that was the end of it. The council could only ever be a beginning, and it had to be a beginning involving everyone, because a church that renews itself has to renew itself at all levels. So, as Archbishop of Kraków, returning from the council, Wojtyła set in motion a programme of prayer, discussion, evangelisation, centred on all the documents of the Council and engaging with them all, studying the Council's sources and working through all its consequences. It was a huge project. It involved people of all kinds, men and women, clerical and lay, workers and intellectuals, thousands of them. It took 7 years. It was not just the conclusions of the process that mattered, it was the process itself. People used their minds. People understood. If you want to be renewed, you need to do the work. That's the sort of thing any life coach will tell you. If you want to be renewed, you need to do the work. Here is another example. One of the key decisions of the Second Vatican Council was that a new, complete, compendious catechism of the Catholic Church needed to be written. It had to set out the whole of the Church's teaching, explaining it, and giving the justification for all her teachings and beliefs. Clear, definite, solid. None of that was what the bureaucrats wanted, so they used the invincible weapon of bureaucrats throughout history, delay. Because popes only live so long, but the Vatican is forever. The new pope was too much for them. He said, simply, that what the council had commanded must be done. The Catechism of the Catholic Church was eventually published in 1992 in French. After more obstruction and more delay, the English version came out in 1994, and over 7 million copies have been sold. Pope John Paul II died in 2005. The BBC, which being British has a duty to ignore the activities of random foreign bishops, found itself broadcasting the entire Requiem Mass live. Watching it, the transition from praying for John Paul in his last illness to praying to him in heaven has never felt more natural. John Paul II continues to inspire us as a man because he shows it really is possible to be a Christian and still be human. Indeed, it is the only way of being fully human at all, and you don't need a doctorate to do it. Now, one of the great things about sanctity is that it is open to everyone to live fully and completely, to be Saint Me. And every Saint Me is different. In heaven, you are going to be you, not someone else. So through your life, you should be trying to be you, the real you, the saint you, not saint somebody quite different. But you do need people like you to encourage you along the way. For this reason, John Paul II presided over many canonizations of all kinds of people from all parts of the world, so that everyone everywhere would have someone to whom they could say, "You were like me, now I want to be a little like you." As a simple and powerful example, on Monday the 20th we have the Feast of the Ugandans, Daudi Okello and Gildo Irwa. They were catechists eager to share their faith, and they were killed for doing just that when they were 16 and 12 years old. In worldly terms, you might think, what a waste. But looking at them in the About Today page for Monday, I find myself saying not interruption, but completion. To have done what needed doing. What more can any of us hope for? If you stand on the south bank of the River Thames in London and look northwards across the river at St. Paul's, you do not see a minaret on the top of it. This ought to be more surprising than it is, but the trouble with history is that we get used to things being the way they are and think that they inevitably have to be like that. On Thursday the 23rd, we commemorate a saint who played a part in keeping us Christian. St. John of Capistrano was born in 1386. For a while he was a judge, and then he became a Franciscan friar. He travelled widely through Germany, Poland, Transylvania, Moldavia, and Russia. Wherever he went, he preached, strengthening Christian morals and combating heresy. In 1453, Constantinople fell to the Turks. After 1,500 years, the Roman Empire was dead. The Turks carried triumphantly on into Europe. They got as far as Belgrade, which they besieged in 1456. John was there. He was 70 years old by then, but he didn't let that stop him. He preached a crusade and pulled together an army of peasants. John Hunyadi, the great Hungarian general, brought a force of 5,000 Hungarians, Czechs, and Poles. They won. The siege of Belgrade was raised. The first thrust of the triumphant Turks had been broken. Even though Belgrade did fall to Suleiman the Magnificent 70 years later, he needed 250,000 men to do it, and even though war followed war through the centuries, still, go and look, there is no minaret on St. Paul's. John died of plague a few months after the victory, but he had accomplished something. There's a neat little chain that connects this week's themes. From Constantinople to Rome, because it was a Turkish gunman who in 1981 shot John Paul II in St. Peter's Square. Then from Rome to Cuba, because on Friday the 24th we celebrate St. Anthony Mary Claret, who survived not one assassination attempt, but 15 of them. He was born near Barcelona in 1807. He preached and gave missions in Catalonia and in the Canary Islands. He founded a missionary order and a religious publishing house which printed millions of cheap copies of Catholic books. In 1849 he was appointed archbishop in Cuba. There he built a hospital and many schools. He set up credit unions to save the poor from the moneylenders. He travelled all over the island and upset many people, lazy and corrupt clerics, exploitative landlords, important people, hence all those attempts to assassinate him. Eventually he returned to Spain, where he became confessor to Queen Isabella II and continued to work to serve the poor and spread learning. It is that business of books that has struck me rather forcefully just now. If millions of copies of Catholic books were printed, it is because millions of Catholic books were wanted. If millions of Catholic books were wanted, it is because millions of people wanted to read them. To humiliate ourselves a bit, remember how much smaller the world's population was then than it is now. So what you might call the demand per person for those books must have been huge. And now I have to confess that I am puzzled. When I was a child, a highlight of going to Mass was seeing afterwards if the church bookstall had anything new. It might be a book, it might more often be a pamphlet at pocket money prices. A small booklet about ante-Nicene Christianity or the religions of Mexico cost as much as a cup of tea and provided entertainment for a week. When I went to school at Downside, they just had books piled up in the abbey porch and you put money in the box, or put in a bit of paper with your name on it. There was C.S. Lewis, there was Teilhard de Chardin, there was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The choice must have been good because there were people, not pious boys, but wild pagan teenagers, who got those books and read them with enthusiasm. And now, look at most churches. Now I'll bet that your parish church is an exception and I'll be embarrassed, but still, look at most churches. Nothing or next to nothing. That is what is puzzling me. Are there no books because no one reads any more? Or does no one read because there's nothing to read? Or perhaps, are there no books and nobody reads them because there isn't anyone who will bring the books and the readers together? So here is a plan. I'll put it as a suggestion to you. Not all of you, but you, if you are old enough not to be working 16-hour days, 7 days a week, but still young enough to have plenty of zip and bounce. You, if you want to do something worthwhile instead of sitting round saying it ought to be done. You, if you are retired enough not to need to make money out of everything you do, and still awake enough to want to do something that does good and is fun. Start like this. Get a carpenter friend to make you a box 4 feet by 6, which unfolds so the two halves make a bookshelf. Get yourself a box or two of books, and get doing. You know all those parishes where everyone is meant to gather together in the hall for refreshments after Mass so we can all be a community together. Then people have nothing to say, they huddle together into shy cliques, or embarrassedly eat a quick biscuit and then disappear. Well then, turn up, open your box, show the books, and talk to everyone. Let them tell you what they like, and you tell them what they ought to try next. You don't need that much capital for a box or two of books. You barely need permission. Just say, "Father, I'm not going to be a nuisance, and best of all, it won't give you any extra work or worry." If Father still won't let you in to do it, stand outside in the street and do it there. If you get arrested for street trading or vagrancy, that'll be a nice dose of martyrdom for you. In areas where there are lots of gardens, herons do a regular circuit of fish ponds to see if the owners have put any new fish in them. Learn from those herons. Pick 4 or 5 parishes and visit each one once a month. Not so often that everyone takes you for granted and ignores you, but often enough that they can look forward to your next visit. What's the worst that can happen? You will have spent a little time and a little money and met some interesting people. Anyway, you can't know till you try. When it comes to setting the world on fire, it is one thing to fail because all the straw you can find is damp and won't light. It is another thing to fail because you never bothered to open a matchbox and strike a match. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.